coming to you from the city where it is illegal for a man to go outside wearing clothing that doesn't match. So I apologize to the NYC public. It's Ventriloquism Weekly. Those openings are getting weirder and weirder as I just try to come up with stuff. Matt Bailey here, hoping you are enjoying your Monday as much as I am. Today, our guest is Australian ventriloquist Darren Carr. I encourage you to go and look up Darren's Australia's Got Talent performances on YouTube. He's hysterical and incredible and one of just a handful of working ventriloquists in Australia. We talk a lot about that today on our interview. And actually, Darren was one of the ventriloquists, I interviewed at Vent Haven last year and lost the file due to a media storage crash. Some of you may remember trying to post and keep you updated on that and had since given up. I have been working to get every single person who was lost when that happened back on the show, and I'm so glad Darren had the time to chat with me yet again, yet for the first airing. With everything about his love for ventriloquism and how he went from being a musician back to being a ventriloquist as a wise business choice, here now our interview with Darren Carr. Darren Carr from Australia, thank you so much for coming on Ventriloquism Weekly. How are you today, sir?
I'm great, Matt. And yourself?
I'm doing great. Where in Australia are you from?
I live in Sydney, a suburb in Sydney, so I'm about half an hour from the centre of Sydney.
Oh,
I suppose you call it the city area.
That's cool.
Been here all my life.
Nice. Now, before we jump in, I owe you an apology. You fell victim to the biggest data crash this program has ever had, and were included on the list of people whose interview I did at Vent Haven in 2014, and I lost your interview thanks to unfortunate circumstances with where I was storing the media. So thank you so much for agreeing to come back on. I've been wanting to have you back on since that happened, and I knew that they wouldn't come back. So thank you.
Our pleasure to be back again.
Again for the first time. All right, so we're going to not waste any more time. Let's jump into it. How'd you get started in ventriloquism?
I was interested in when I was a boy, about 8 or 9, I saw an Australian ventriloquist, Chris Kirby. I saw him perform, and that sort of piqued my interest in it. And then played with it for a couple of years and then got interested in music. So that took over for quite a while and made my living as a musician for years. And then at the age of about 30, I decided to give ventriloquism a go again. And that's what happened.
That's cool. Why'd you decide to, where'd that come from musician back to ventriloquist?
I just saw the music industry going sort of downhill as far as being able to make a living out of it. A lot of venues closing and bands getting less money, and I'd had enough. I didn't want to be going out and playing till 2 a.m. In my 50s. I just didn't see the future in it. And yeah. So I tried to find something that was a little more, a little more easy going.
That's cool. So
this seems to have worked.
So you found your way back. What's the secret? You've made your living in show business, whether it be musician or ventriloquism. You've made a living doing this, which so many people, they start out either employed by a company and then they go full time, or they just sort of jump in and do it and are successful right away. How did that look kind of find you to be able to do it just full time without any worry?
Two things. Mainly, my father was a musician, so he was well known in the entertainment industry here in Australia. So once I started, people sort of half knew me already through him. Mm-hmm. So getting work wasn't too difficult. Plus the fact that I try to, do my best at what I do and try to please an audience, I think is the main thing. I don't do it for me. I do it to entertain people. And if you're doing that, I think that's the secret to it. Well, I just find it's easier to get work if you're entertaining and you're there for the audience rather than for yourself.
Very cool. Very cool. I'm going to, yeah, that, I have a thing I want to talk to you about, but I think we'll get there organically. So if I sound like I'm trailing off, it's because I'm thinking about that. But yeah, I certainly think, do you think a lot of people that aren't successful do it because they're in it for themselves?
Well, it depends what successful means. It's you can be successful to yourself if you want to do it as a hobby, or you want to do kids' parties, or you whatever level you want to do ventriloquism at, you can be successful at it. My prime thing was I wanted to do it as a living. I wanted to be a professional and get to the stage where I could make a comfortable living out of it. So that's my level of what I wanted to be as far as successful goes. But I look, the underlying thing is it's entertainment. And if you intend to do it for the public, you have to be entertaining. So I think that's all. You have to be funny. That's a big thing too. If you're, not many serious ventriloquists around, I found. But I think just engaging an audience, keeping them smiling and laughing for 30, 40 minutes or whatever you do, that's it. If you can succeed at doing that, then there's no reason why you shouldn't be working. And, like, it's easy for me too. I'm in Australia where we have about 16, 17 million people.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, there's three ventriloquists.
There's you. And who are the other two?
There's Dean Atkinson. And Sarah Jones.
Oh, cool.
And as far as I know, we're the only three that do it full time. There's as far as adult shows go,
right.
There's quite there's probably a few doing children's stuff. But, we make our living pretty much doing the adult ventriloquism.
So how does that sound like a shrink? How does that feel knowing you get to be in a realm where there's – if there's no competition, if it's not that there's no competition, there's certainly enough work. I remember from the last time we spoke, there's certainly enough work to go around. How does that feel being in an environment where it's kind of open to you since it's what you've chosen to do?
Oh, I feel very blessed. It was a business decision. As I said, being a musician, I knew I wasn't making the money and I wasn't going to make the money that I thought I'd want to make. So it was finding a career supply versus demand. There was a demand in the corporate industry for a ventriloquist because we didn't have one working the corporate market out here. And that's, I saw that. And over the space of sort of a 6-7 year period, that's what I aimed to be able to do. And that's what I've had my success at, is doing the corporate market. So.
And it's that success in a very interesting way that I'm going to allude to the story. You'll know what I'm talking about, but I want you to tell it. It's actually that success and having cornered that market that led you to be able to sort of dictate how your appearance on Australia's Got Talent went.
Yeah, well, they'd been contacting me every year since the show started. I think it was like 6 or 7 years. And I always said no because there was never a comedian on the judging panel. And like, I know it's not, the show's not set up for comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's set up for more musical acts.
Yeah.
I thought I'd have a better chance of making myself look, a little better if there was a comedian on there that could accept what I do. So finally they had, Dawn French, an English comedian. I was told she was going to be a judge. So that's why I said yes to that particular year. Now, I still didn't really want to do it, but I thought it's publicity and TV time is hard to get, as it is anywhere. And so it's pretty much the only opportunity in Australia to be on TV as far as the ventriloquist is concerned. So that's why I said yes to it. But I was able to, as you said, not write my own rules for the show, but right. Because they needed me more than I needed them.
Yeah.
They were struggling for decent acts that were different. So I was able to say, no, I'm not you know, I'm not dressing up like they wanted me to dress up. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. I'll do what I want to do. And I didn't have to go through the initial auditioning process. Yeah, just stuff like that. It was just made it a little easier, and just being able to set my own terms made it a little more at ease for me to be able to do it and try to do it to a level that I thought would be all right for TV.
Yeah, you got.
So I think I succeeded in that, but I got through to almost the end.
Yeah,
but
and you got some pretty good viral videos. I know that when you were doing it, it like went around the world because you were using the Axtel toucan and you had your stuff, and you were being very, very inventive with it.
Yeah, yeah. My son told me the other day that it's up near 4 million or something. So wow. That's pretty good. I'm pretty happy with that.
That's really cool. Now we'll talk about the success of going viral in a minute. But you did touch on something with your AGT. Hate the first initials, the same here, AGT, and
yep.
Australia's Got Talent, that they were struggling for good acts, but they portray it here in America like there's just this sea of people that show up everywhere they go. Is there a severe lack of interest in entertainment, in doing entertainment in Australia, in being an entertainer?
Yeah, the mindset in Australia is a little different to the States.
How so?
Like I've worked a bit in the States, mm-hmm. and I've worked a lot on cruise ships for American audiences. They tend to be more accepting of entertainers. Mm-hmm. They see it as something a little more special. In Australia, it's more a sport mentality. You can be held up to the highest level if you're a sporting, you know, if you're a footballer or cricketer or whatever. If you're an entertainer, it's a different kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, the entertainers that are out here nowadays, the majority from the from shows like AGT or like all our top music performers and whatnot have all come from reality TV shows, X Factor and all that. So it's I don't know, it's totally different. There's no show business anymore. Like it used to be. It used to be an industry where, you know, the live performances and everything, it's not based on that anymore. It's all based on reality TV and if you're a celebrity or not.
Yeah, very interesting, and I think that's worldwide. I think, you know, we talk with Jay Johnson sometimes on the show, and he'll come on and he'll talk about his days at the Horn Comedy Club where he would, you know, tread the boards and then somebody saw him and had him come on the TV show, and I think very much, which was soap, and I think very much it's become the opposite. You have to get on television in order to get on stage, you know?
Oh, definitely, definitely. No, I shouldn't say there's no comedy scene out here for as far as comedy clubs go, but there's very few. They're lucky to be, well, there's a comedy club in Sydney, the Comedy Store, but they're to the stage now where they're just having 10 acts a night and every act does 10 minutes and that's how long the show goes for, and they schlep all those people out and then do it again later in the evening. Apart from that, there's a few pubs that have a comedy night once a week, but you couldn't make a living out of it. There's no, you know, they're all giving $100 per performer and whatnot. A lot of the comedy performers now find their way on TV. They're on a panel show, or they're doing clips here and there. Some guys doing pod stuff. Some guys doing internet shows. It's very sad. it's very sad. All those, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, I mentioned Chris Kirby earlier.
Yeah.
In the 70s in Australia, he had his own Tonight Show on TV.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so, you know, a ventriloquist had his own Tonight Show, and there was three or four Tonight Shows on TV that constantly had ventriloquist acts on. But now, there's no chance of you getting on TV apart from going on reality TV, which is, you know.
Do you think it's because they like to see little puppet boy and little guy with the microphone thrown to the fire?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, that's what, you know, they were, I would say they were upset when I actually went on and did well, but it was, they had to change their thinking. They thought it was going to be a freak show, and then I went on there and the act went well, but I also, you know, when they were talking to me, I also was able to think on my feet and come back at the judges,
mm-hmm.
which the audience got off on. And I think they suddenly went, hold it, this guy's, you know, this guy's talented. He actually do it.
Why do we do that? Because we do that worldwide. Why do we look at somebody who's going to go, because everybody says the audience roots for you, the audience roots for you. Except in those situations, kind of hoping to see a train wreck and then, okay, he's good. Well, dang it, he's good. But okay, we can enjoy some good entertainment until the next terrible act comes out. Where did that come from?
I have no idea. Probably the internet, you know.
Probably.
Would you get on YouTube? Would you rather watch a plane land properly or a plane land that's going all over the place?
Right.
It's that, you know, it's people don't stop halfway down the freeway because someone's driving really well. They're stopping halfway down the freeway because there's an accident on the other side of the road and they want to see that.
Right.
It's I don't know, it's the mentality of people nowadays. I don't know, just remember the 60s and 70s when people wanted to go see a show, to go see live entertainment. It was a special thing. And nowadays it's not. You know, it's just, it's, I don't know. It's sad.
Yeah, it really is. But hey, you're having success at it, and I would assume even more success since that thing hits almost 4 million views, your appearance on your AGT. What's that been like? Getting recognized more, getting more shows?
I don't know if the shows went up, purely for the fact that the people that watch AGT, kids, families, you know, sitting at home doing nothing on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, whereas my audience where I get work are businessmen. It's all corporate stuff. So I wasn't getting bookings from it. I do get a lot of people come up to me at the gigs and say, oh, we saw you on TV or, you know, where's the toucan and stuff like that. But I don't think it really went from getting – I didn't get extra work out of AGT, put it that way. I got a lot of phone calls from it, but people wanting me to do their kids' birthday parties and stuff like that. Because the stuff I did on AGT wasn't indicative of what I do at a corporate event anyway. It wasn't the same material. That was purely done to fit family TV.
And how important was that to you? What was the thought process in putting that material together to go on TV versus the corporate shows?
Oh, it was more the fact of just trying to get as many spots as I could on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to, you know, I had to just make it as family friendly each week and just aim it at a family audience. If I had gone on there with my mini me doll and just done part of my corporate act, it wouldn't have cut the mustard. It needed the I had to dumb it down and use color and movement.
Yeah.
So I figured the toucan was the best way to go. It's a great looking puppet.
Yes.
And I had the idea pretty much from the beginning that I would start with it on my arm.
Mm-hmm.
And so then if I got through, which I figured I would get through the first lot of audition, or the first round, that the second round I could use the animatronic version and that would just give it another twist. The third spot, which I didn't get to do, which would have been the grand final, was going to be the animatronic toucan with the animatronic old man that I have as well, the Axtor one,
yes,
playing the piano. So he's playing the piano while we're both singing with a guy from the audience wearing a mask. I was going to just throw everything into the whole two-minute spot and but just go from one level to the next. And that was the plan. Anyway, I didn't get to the last one. But look, it was good. There was no negatives from it. Right. I didn't get any negative response from it. So it was good in that respect. But it certainly didn't parlay into extra work for me.
Right. And I think that could also just be a product of, again, not having so many people in Australia do what you do, that it just, you know, more work or stay the same. You're still working all the time, you know, which is fantastic. You know, what was your end goal then? If it wasn't more work, what was the end game for you with the appearances?
Oh, just profile, just public profile. I do some public shows. Mm-hmm. I just finished a tour here with Dina Martin, Dean Martin's daughter. She came out and toured. So I just did 10 shows with her out here. And a lot of people coming up going, we saw you on Australia's Got Talent and whatnot. So it's good in that respect that it helps me get public work. But the public work isn't my main forum. It's not where my money comes from and whatnot. It's just nice to do a bit of show business now and again, get out there and, you know, she had a nice great band behind her, and the audience came to see a show, and, you know, there wasn't a corporate audience where they've come in for dinner and they want to network and they want to, you know, have a few too many drinks and pick up at the end of the evening. And, you know, suddenly there's this fat guy on stage in a dodgy suit with a puppet, you know, wasting half their evening.
How do you nab them in that situation? How do you nab the audience that is not very entertainment minded coming in?
Well, you have to go for the throat. You have to walk out and be totally assured of yourself. You can't go out and, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to be here. What a pleasure. You've just got to go straight for the throat. My usual opening line is, usually, thank you. I've never heard of me either, because there's usually they introduce you. You never get a great introduction, because it's usually the director or someone introducing you. Yeah. So you get, we got someone to entertain you now. We think he's pretty funny. He's Daryl Carr. They normally get your name wrong, and so you've got to walk straight out there and thank you very much. I've never heard of me either. What a financial pleasure it is to be here. Just bang straight into it, and. And that's what I do. I come out and I do about 7 or 8 minutes of just stand-up, which is usually just self-deprecating stuff about me being overweight and losing my hair and the fact that I'm single or being married, just all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And that parlays into, you know, the reason I am single is probably because I'm a ventriloquist.
Yeah. You know? And then that's into the characters.
And then I straight into the, yeah. So I get them laughing straight off. Then if they don't like my stand up, it only lasts 7 minutes, and then I pull the doll out.
Yeah.
So they might like the doll. They might like the fact that the doll starts abusing people and having a go at me and whatnot. And if they're not into that, then I finish with the mask routine, which, you know, as we all know, is it works Killer. Itself.
Killer.
You know, it's just me finding the right person.
The mask is the ventriloquist version of the self-working card trick.
Oh, it is. Just, and, you know, I can fully appreciate whoever invented it being upset. Let's not say who it was, but there's, you know, various stories to that. But it's just a great bit. It's just if I could find something that worked better, I would use it.
Yeah.
Because I think the mask's getting a little overused. I've even tried putting the mask on the puppet just for something different.
Yeah.
But to a ventriloquist audience, that might work at a convention, the vent convention, get the gag. But to a lay audience, nah, it didn't. So it's normally finished with me. I have been using the doll as well as of someone. So the doll keeps talking to the volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just me, the volunteer, just trying to play it a little bit differently. But yeah, still trying to work out different ways to do it. It's never – the act's never the same twice. I couldn't do that. There's a lot of material, but I never do the same show twice. It just plays – I play with whatever the audience is going with. Sometimes it's all male. Sometimes it's just – females, sometimes it's mixed, sometimes it's kids, you know, so it's got to be clean, yet it's got to be funny, it's got to be a bit edgy, it's got to, you know,
It's got to cover everything in. So,
but it's got to be aimed at that particular audience at that particular show.
Exactly.
That's what it is. If you don't aim it at that audience and you're slightly off the target, and they won't like you as much as they should, well, you're not doing your job properly. It's the way I look at it. You're there for them.
Exactly. You are there for them. How do you do that? How do you customize the material? Or is it just going out without a script and just doing the intake of the audience and ripping into them?
Yeah, I have bits. I have little bits, and it's usually the bits are on sort of a subject. So maybe not a subject as in, you know, being married or being, you know, fat or being divorced, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just the general vibe. So it's more a vibe than a subject. It's a little weird. I don't even understand it myself, but I know I have these bits and they all link together. And I'll walk out, as I said, and do the stand-up stuff. And that's pretty generic, as in I know that works for most audiences. Even kids laugh at the jokes. Then when I pull my mini-me out, Daryl, pull him out, that's when it changes. If it's kids in the audience, he'll engage them first, because you can always work off the kids. The kids will always yell out stuff, and so it's good fun to play. And the adults like that if you're engaging with the kids. But you still got to keep it enjoyable for the adults too.
Absolutely.
If it's just an adult audience, you can pretty much get away with anything. If it's all men, it's anything plus anything else you can think of.
Yeah.
There's no rules, but you've just got to be able to look at your audience and know exactly what they would enjoy, what they want to hear. It's like when I did the Dina Martin tour recently. That was, you know, older people, because, you know, they come to see Dean Martin's daughter and they've come to see a show. So I took out the element of the doll being abusive to the audience, or being, you know, being nasty to the audience. Like, she used a different doll. I used a different Selberg figure that would be a little more friendly towards that sort of audience.
Yes, because they're there for that environment.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm not there. I'm not the star of the show. I'm there to warm up the crowd for the headliner.
Mm-hmm.
So I just need to do a good solid half an hour that was funny to put people in a good mood.
And how long are the corporate shows as opposed to acting as the opening act?
Oh, whatever they want. I don't set a time limit as far as what I do, because they're paying you to do a job. Mm-hmm. So I figure, you know, if they want 5 minutes, I just got a contract through for a 10-minute spot. So I'm flying to Perth to do 10 minutes. When Perth is like, it's the equivalent of going from LA to New York.
Wow.
So I'll go there and just do a 10-minute spot to open up a conference. But then on the other hand, sometimes they want an hour. You know, you're the only thing on that night. They've got two speeches that are going for 5 minutes. They've got dinner, and there's no disco or band or anything. You're the entertainment for the night. So they want an hour.
What's the best of those environments?
I have no preference. Every audience is different. The best environment for it is, of course, when you've got a nice stage with lighting and a good sound system and everyone's facing you. they're not necessarily it. Oh, no. Some of the setups you get are just mm-hmm. crazy. And you try to work it as best you can, but without being rude to the organizer. So I try to say, look, it's not a good idea to have people to the side of the stage. You know, make sure everyone's sort of within a 90-degree fan from the front of the stage outwards. And then, 45 degrees it'll be, mm-hmm. that way. So everyone sort of can see you. Everyone can hear you. That's what I tend to tell most of the event organisers anyway. Just make sure I can be easily seen and heard. So no major huge decorations in the middle of the table or balloons, or, you know, just make sure there's at least one really strong light on the stage.
Yeah.
Just try to make it as easy for them as possible, you know, but at the same time, you gotta tell them what they need to do. Because some of them are a bit thick.
And it's important to realize they're hiring you, and they're hiring, you're exactly right. I think what we tend to forget is they're hiring you, and also you have that leeway. You have the right to tell them the show will not, the event that you were planning, and it will look bad on you, is not going to go well if you don't listen, or at least let me make some suggestions just so that everything flows nicely and you look good.
That's it. And that's, you know, it's I can't control the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I can't control, you know, the weather outside. I can't control what time of the day or night the function is, but I can control to an extent what's going to happen when I perform.
Exactly.
In other words, what I do, and hence, but I have to make that ideal for me. So I won't tell the organizer what to do, but I just sort of suggest to them, look, if you don't have light so I can be seen, if you've got more than 100 people, a stage is a good idea, you know, a good sound system so I can be heard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Then my end line to them all is that, you know, if you don't have that, you're wasting your money, because yeah. Then I'm there, and yet I can't be seen or heard properly. And once they know, if they think they're wasting their money, or they're throwing away money is the key.
Yes,
they think they're getting their money's worth. That's when they go, oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, let's move those tables, or let's, you know, if you try to make it sound like you're doing it for you, you know, I want the tables moved over that way. I want, you know, that's when they, oh, no, I don't like him.
Yeah.
We won't book him again. That's, you know, but if you say, oh, you might be sort of losing, you know, interest from the audience. If they can't see me, then they're going to start talking and you know, that's going to end up, interrupt other people listening, and that the money's the big thing. You mentioned money, oof, everything gets done.
And we are, that's great. I'm going to stop there. Before we do our patented last question, you are going to be the guinea pig for a new segment called Best, Worst, and Biggest. And I'm going to ask you three questions. I'm going to ask you three questions. I want you to tell me. Best show. Best show.
Best show. There was a comedy duo called Hale and Pace. They're English, and they were out here doing a tour, and I toured with them. And we did a theatre in Adelaide. And for some reason, I just walked on stage, and from the first joke, there was a wall of laughter came back at me. Nothing, I've never had anything like that as far as, you know, it was 2,500 people, I think, in the theatre, and the wall of laughter. And it went for the whole 30 minutes.
Wow.
And yeah, to the point where I walked off, and as I was walking off, they were coming on stage. Awesome. And they said a couple of words to me, as in, how dare you go so well, you know. In a nice way, they were lovely guys, but it wasn't anything nasty, but they felt the pressure.
Yeah. Wasn't your fault. They were just raring to go.
And which was great. That was the best one ever. That's like, I can never forget that, yeah.
Worst show.
Oh, look, nothing springs to mind. There's been a couple of corporate jobs where, once again, it's just things out of your control. You know, there's the old story that did happen to me where they, you know, just before they announce you, they say, we'd like to have 2 minutes silence for Joe Smith, who passed away yesterday. And they have the 2 minute silence, and then they go, now here's our comedian, and you walk onto nothing, and everyone's crying already. Yeah. And yeah, so I've had that happen to me. That wasn't, you know, but it's a challenge then.
Yeah.
You've got to make them happy. You've got to get them on your side. You know, so it's fun in that respect. And at the end of the night, I had people coming up saying, thanks for that. We really enjoyed it. You know, we forgot about how sad we were feeling, things like that. So been a couple of those difficult situations, but I try to get myself out of them so the whole job doesn't suck.
And the biggest laugh you ever got?
Wow. It was probably one of those ones in Adelaide that night at the theatre, I'd say.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
I still remember doing a cruise ship once, and this old couple decided to walk straight down the middle aisle of the theatre in the middle of the show. But not only did they get to the stage, then they both went separate ways trying to find a seat. And this must have gone on. And so I'm looking at them and the doll's looking at them, but I had the presence of mind for me to follow the old lady who went left and for the doll to follow the old man that went right. So we're each looking at one another, and they're just looking for a seat, pretty much oblivious to the fact that I'm on stage.
It's hysterical. Oh, my God.
And the audience laughed on. These two people must have taken 4 minutes before they actually seats together, called the other person over, and the whole time I didn't say a word. We're just watching them. And I'm having the doll look at me and sort of, you know, look at me and then look back at them. And that was great. That felt really good, and it wasn't jokes. Yeah. They weren't jokes. They were just us playing with the audience. And yeah, that was a good laugh. I remember that.
That's great. And our last question, what do you want to see from Ventriloquist just coming up, just getting started?
Just funny. Funny. That's it. I think that's lip technique, of course, is important. Your characters are important. The splitting between your personality and your character's personality, it's all very important. It's all the basics of ventriloquism, but funny. Funny. I've got 6 rows of joke books, and I watch so much comedy, and I'm writing down stuff all the time. And
do you still laugh? Because I know so many comedians.
Oh, I'd rather watch a good comedy than anything else. Yeah, definitely. I love watching comedy, good comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I've got my own little quirky stuff that I enjoy, but this, yeah, I have no problem sit down and watching Jim Gaffigan or someone like that and laughing out loud. It's just, yeah, certain guys just really grab my sense of humour. So I can still laugh with the best of them. I've no problem with that. I've had many laughs at the conventions, the vent conventions.
Yes, sir. Just
people like John Pizzi and I remember Ricky Lane back in Vegas once. Man, I laughed and laughed and laughed. He was hilarious. So, yeah, I'm happy to laugh with the best of them. Jeff Dunham, at the last convention, I'll shout this out then. Jeff Dunham, at the last convention, when he had, Ahmed reading the noodles.
Yeah.
So much newfounded respect for Jeff after watching him ad-lib reading a box of noodles. That was hilarious.
That's going to stick out in my mind.
A real talent, a real ventriloquist talent that knows what he's doing. And, man, if everyone aspired to be as good as him, ventriloquism would be the healthiest career you could have, I reckon.
Awesome, and that's a great note to end it on. Darren Carr, all the way from Australia, good morning, as we say good evening here in the States. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Matt.
Darren, it is much appreciated that you took the time to do this yet again. I promised you it would air this time, and look, it did. It didn't get lost. Again, I encourage everyone to go and look Darren up. I will link through to some of my favorite performances of him on his country's AGT. Some quick housekeeping. I want to mention once again this week that the Sit Stand is available at ShowtimeMagic.com and will soon be available at world-famous Axtel Expressions website, axtel.com as well. That's it for us this week. Next week, we have a fantastic time with the incredible Mark Daniel. I'd been promising him his own episode since CAX 2014, and we finally got to do it, and we just have a blast. A reminder, you can find all you need to know about Ventriloquism Weekly by going to our website, ventriloquismweekly.com. Reach out to me. It is me. I have the email on my phone. I read it. I look. ventriloquismweekly@gmail.com. And find our page on Facebook at facebook.com/talkfortwo. I was going to tell you to search for our group, and you can do that, ventriloquismweekly-podcast4ventriloquist. Tweet at us or tweet about us using at or hashtag talkfortwo, TALKFORTWO. You know it by now. And you can even hashtag on Facebook. That's our little handle. From New York, signing off for Ventriloquism Weekly, I'm Matt Bailey, reminding all you vents out there to keep talking for two.